Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. The U.S. and Russia, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, this hour of the program with Professor Ted Gerber. He's a professor of sociology and director of the Center for Russia, East Europe and Central Asia at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is the author of a number of publications on the labor market in post-Soviet Russia, the changing family formation behavior in post-socialist countries, and a piece this summer in the Washington Quarterly, which caught our attention. Does Russian propaganda work? There's a lot going on, of course, on this story, and it changes every day. Outgoing CIA Director John Brennan had an interview with the Wall Street Journal published yesterday. He referred to Donald Trump tweeting last week about the unverified intelligence dossier. The tweet, intelligence agencies should never have allowed this fake news to leak into the public. One last shot at me. Are we living in Nazi Germany? On Sunday, Donald Trump accused Brennan of being the leaker of fake news. Brennan said, I think it's right and indeed the response of the president of the U.S. to challenge the conclusions of the intelligence community. But it crosses a line to accuse these agencies of leaks. And he rejects the accusation that he leaked the intelligence report that was written by the former British spy Christopher Steele. On today, actually, Vladimir Putin said an unsubstantiated report that alleged Russia had gathered compromising material on Trump was a hoax, and he slammed those who were propagating the allegations as worse than prostitutes. Donald Trump has been tweeting about Vladimir Putin for a long, long time. We'll talk about some of those tweets and what the relationship here is. Learn a little bit more about Vladimir Putin because our guest knows a whole lot about what's going on in Russia. And we will talk about the various agencies that are looking into this dossier and into the possible business dealings between Trump and Russia, and the list goes on. We will be welcoming phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Ted Gerber is our guest, and we thank you, Professor Gerber, for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. There's so much going on that it's hard to know where to. It just goes on and on and on. Let's just start, if you don't mind, with this relationship. And they don't know each other, really, but this relationship between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. Donald Trump has been praising Vladimir Putin for years now. I was looking at a tweet June 18th of 2013. Do you think Putin will be going to the Miss Universe pageant in November in Moscow? If so, will he become my new best friend? And the tweets go on and on, praising his op-ed piece in the New York Times, Putin, saying it was tough and amazingly well written, makes Obama look like a school child. Some of this really goes back 2008, told a Russian language magazine, Siegel, I really like Vladimir Putin. I respect him. He does his job well, much better than our Bush. So it goes way back here. What's it all about?
Well, I think our president-elect is reacting to an image that Putin has tried and, in fact, succeeded in projecting for quite some time of himself as being a very effective leader. The types of adjectives that Trump has used to characterize him are exactly what he has sought to associate with himself, adjectives such as strong, tough. And he, you know, both through his actions and through a very concerted propaganda effort going back to the early 2000s, has really succeeded in showing the world and both the external world and, more importantly, his domestic audience these characteristics. And I think Trump is simply reacting to you know, choosing to emphasize those aspects of his, you know, Putin's image rather than other aspects. So in the West, actions that, you know, might be perceived as violating international law or as cracking down unnecessarily on civil liberties and democracy, those could be, to some people, those could be portrayed as simply as tough steps taken in response to trying circumstances in order to preserve the well-being of the country. So Trump as you pointed out, does have a long record of admiring those sorts of capabilities.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more about the propaganda effort. How is it conducted? Where is it conducted? Is it conducted headed by Vladimir Putin?
Well, I don't know that he actually micromanages the campaign, but there's no question that his policy for quite some time now, and this has really snuck up on people, observers in the West, but really since the mid-2000s, it has been a comprehensive campaign to project what some of my political science colleagues might call a strategic narrative about the role of Russia in the world, the advantages of Russia, the strengths of Russia, the threats posed to Russia. So first of all, content-wise, the message has been a coherent one of Russia having a distinctive civilization, a distinctive national tradition that distinguishes it from the West, and that is superior in many ways to Western institutions such as democracy and civil rights and markets and so forth. And against this, Russia is portrayed as having more of a traditional system where the state and the collectivity is more important than the individual, where the state is responsible for providing for the population. It's a socially conservative image that, in contrast with the supposed decadence of Western society, it's connected to Russian Orthodox Christian tradition. So that's the content. In terms of the form, this propaganda campaign has taken a variety of forms. So first of all, perhaps most importantly, Russia has created – the Russian government consolidated control over domestic media sources, the main national media sources, under Putin's regime, which started in 2000. And secondly, it's invested a lot of money in projecting its message abroad. So through television networks such as what's now called RT, used to be called Russia Today, and a series of other media corporations – the Russian government has put forth its story about itself, its narrative about Russia, and it's and that also comes with the flip side of that is a narrative about the West, which it portrays as being hostile to Russia, as having negative, malevolent intentions, a lot of anti-U.S. Notions, in addition to portraying the U.S. as having aspirations of controlling the entire world, of imposing its values and ideas and interests upon the rest of the world, of being hypocritical in its advocacy of notions such as democracy, which it portrays as just a smokescreen for naked, raw U.S. power. And so these vast television and internet and print media network reaches all over the world these days, and the Russian government invests billions of dollars. And it's really taken the art of fake news, so to speak, and turned it – well, it's taken the, I guess, the sort of the new craft of fake news and turned it into an art form.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Gerber, who's believing it?
Well, it's a little hard to say. So I think one of the challenges we face is this is really a new world. I mean, governments have always engaged in propaganda activities, and we're familiar with propaganda activities of authoritarian governments. When we speak of the United States, and the United States, of course, also attempts to project a positive image of itself throughout the world, we often refer to that as soft power as opposed to propaganda, but the distinction is perhaps more academic than realistic. And in the United States, the United States government does not have the equivalent propaganda complex. But in terms of who believes it, we just don't know yet. There's starting to be some studies to try to measure the impact of Russian government messaging on various populations. So the article that you referred to by myself and my colleague at University of Arizona, Gene Zavisco, what we did is we did surveys in Russia, Ukraine, Azerbaijan, and Kyrgyzstan, and we tried to assess the extent to which the populations in those four countries, so including Russia itself, buy into the key components of the Kremlin's narrative.
Mm-hmm. So if you're watching television in Russia, are you only seeing the arm of the government at work? Are you seeing any opposing voices?
No, you're not seeing opposing voices. The first thing you said is correct, that you're only seeing the government's perspective. So, and it actually can be quite disturbing. So I should point out that although, you know, the propaganda campaign, the propaganda machinery, if you will, it goes back to the mid-2000s, it was really ramped up in 2014 following the Kremlin's activities or annexation of Crimea and then its incursions into the Donbas or region of eastern Ukraine. And that, of course, led to a response by NATO and the United States and the EU in terms of sanctions. And it really sent to an acceleration or exacerbation of the tensions between the two countries. And at that point, Russia really ramped up the extent of its anti-American, anti-Western messaging. And so in Russia, if you turn on the TV at that time, you could, and still today, I mean, I actually haven't been since last summer, but I imagine it hasn't changed much. If you turn on the TV, you'll see lots of negative reports about U.S. aggression all over the world. You'll see reports about the Russian government defending innocent civilians all over the world from U.S. attacks. There are lots of very extreme reporting about what was going on in Ukraine, for example. I mean, mm-hmm. That was a very signature moment, in fact, the so-called Maidan movement, which eventually overthrew Yanukovych, who was the Kremlin's preferred president or the preferred leader in Ukraine. He was elected through a democratic process, but was heavily supported by the Kremlin. And that really occurred right in Russia's backyard and was a real sore spot for the Russian government. And so a lot of the, you know, it's indeed the case that you get a very kind of a streamlined pro-government or pro-Russian government perspective. There's no oppositional voices to speak of. You can find in some websites the government sort of is softly challenging a lot of internet reporting and a lot of opposition type media outlets that function mainly on the internet, but they still are able to operate. So those who in Russia who really want to find an alternative perspective, you know, they do have access to Western media. The government hasn't shut that down, although they make sounds and make noises from time to time of plans to control the internet in various ways. But really it's the domination of the television and broadcast news that is a hallmark of the Russians' domestic propaganda.
Mm-hmm. Would you, on RT or on Russian internet information, hear anything about this British intelligence agent's report on possible collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign?
Yes, you would hear that this is a ridiculous hoax manufactured by the enemies of Russia that shows how desperate Russia's enemy, you know, Russia's opponents are in the powerful circles of the establishment of the United States and Britain, and you know, it would just be kind of a mocking account of how ridiculous and silly all these claims are, which, you know, essentially puppets what Putin himself has said and what his spokespersons have said in response to this dossier issue.
Mm-hmm. And if you were the FBI, I'm not sure what they're doing in this regard or what the Intelligence Committee will do in this regard, but if you were trying to verify this story, what kind of access would you have with possible sources in Russia? How difficult would it be if somebody wanted to really let us know what the truth is? And a lot of people want to know what the truth is. Would it be hard for somebody to talk? Would it be hard to find a source to verify or to repudiate these stories?
Yes, I think it would be very hard to find either at this point. One way to think about this, and you know, I don't want to be alarmist, and I don't want to shock anyone, but there's a lot of discussion both among the media and among academic observers about whether or not we're in a new Cold War type of environment. And I think, you know, the answer is that Russia, from my perspective, and this is just my opinion, others may disagree with me. From my perspective, it is the case that for, you know, a good 5 to 10 years now, Russia has considered itself, has behaved as if it is in a state of war or warlike conflict with the United States. And we are only now sort of catching up to realizing that that has been its posture toward us. Now, the war is not one of tanks and planes and nuclear weapons, although nuclear weapons do enter into it as part of the strategic issue that goes into this. But instead, the war has been one of trying to undermine, or from the Russian strategy has been to try to undermine the cohesion and the strength, in essence, of the United States and its allies through these propaganda efforts and through other efforts. I mean, both through its actions and through its propaganda. So given that that is the case, it would be very dangerous for someone within the Russian establishment to provide evidence that would either confirm confirm the claims of the dossier. Now, does that mean that the dossier, that the allegations in the dossier are true? Well, no, of course not. But it also means that, however, that we should take the denials of the Kremlin with a grain of salt. I mean, of course they're going to deny it. They're not going to no Kremlin spokesman is going to come out and say, well, yes, of course, we have this compromising material on the president-elect, and yes, we tried to interfere with the U.S. election. So it's not really news that Russia is denying it. In terms of whether or not we will ever know the truth, I think that's very hard to say. It could be a kind of thing where, some 20 or 30 years from now, where some of the key actors are retiring and writing their memoirs, we may get some sense of what's going on at that point. But I'm skeptical. And in fact, I think, a lot of what the Russian – so the Russian campaign operates on two levels. First of all, it tries to – delegitimize the United States and the claims of the West. And second of all, it tries to cast doubt on the very knowability of the truth, on whether or not there is a truth out there. It's almost, ironically, it's almost sort of postmodern, one might say, in its inspiration, that it tries to cast doubt on the very knowability of facts about the world by reporting all kinds of different perspectives. And so I think, it's almost a fool's errand to say, well, and I'm not an investigator. I don't know what tools the FBI and the CIA have. Hopefully they have some kind of human intelligence or some kind of sources. But I'm very skeptical that we're ever going to know what actually happened. And so both those who are casting doubt on the dossier and those who take it at its face value, I think, are reflecting more their perceptions about the current state of affairs between the two countries than they are really giving a hard-headed analysis.
Oh, that's interesting.
Of the fact.
20 or 30 years, people want information that they can say true or not true before that. What about Israeli intelligence? What about British intelligence? They're on the case too, aren't they?
Yes, I really am not familiar with their capacities or their perspectives. I mean, of course, Steele himself is a former British intelligence operative. One would expect that the Brits would be all over this. The Israelis, I really don't know. I haven't followed their involvement in the story, so mm-hmm. I can't say.
Well, what about this other aspect? And there are so many aspects of this story. The outgoing director of the CIA, who's being chastised by Donald Trump, who's accusing him of being the leaker of fake news. This seems to be an extreme accusation to make against a guy who's been in intelligence for a long period of time. And also his comments about Donald Trump has really established this incredibly negative relationship with the intelligence agencies. So if you're trying to, on all kinds of levels, find out the truth about what Russia's designs are on other countries and their sphere in the hemisphere, it would seem as though you may have to rely, not that there are always accurate reports, on intelligence agencies' analysis of what's going on. How does this complicate the relationship Donald Trump may have with the intelligence community, understanding what Russia's all about?
Well, in my view, I mean, it not only compromises the relationship between the incoming president and the intelligence community with respect to Russia, but it compromises poisons that relationship overall. I think it's been a huge disservice to the intelligence community and to the prospect of developing a coherent American government response to not only to Russia but to the various challenges that face the United States throughout the world that require competent intelligence. So I certainly agree with all the criticisms that have been voiced of the incoming president. I think even if he does have a beef with the intelligence agencies, which it doesn't seem to me on the face of it that there's any evidence that anyone in the intelligence agency has in any way been biased against Trump. If anything, quite the opposite. From going back to the campaign and mm-hmm. Comey's revelations at the week before the election or whatever it was, 2 weeks about the new supposedly controversial Hillary Clinton emails. So I see no evidence anyway that the intelligence, nor can I think of any reason why any of the intelligence agencies would have anything, reason to be ill-disposed towards Trump. And even if he did have a case to be made, that case should be made in private, not in public, where he's really casting doubts on the dedication and devotion, the competence of our intelligence agencies, with absolutely not a shred of evidence behind his accusations. I think it's extremely harmful, extremely damaging. And I think the Russians are laughing their heads off, frankly. I think the Russian government could not have envisioned a better scenario for its efforts to undermine not only the actual functioning of American political institutions. I mean, where they've, among other things, I mean, this is just one thing, where they've created a conflict between the president and the intelligence leaders of the intelligence agency, whose job it is to provide him and his associates with information about what's going on in the world and what the threats are. Not only has have Russia's actions contributed to creating that rift, but they've also made that contributed towards a perception on the part of the American public that we can't trust our president-elect or we can't trust our intelligence agencies. So the fact that he has made this into a public dispute is deeply damaging, and I think it's really hard to see how we can restore public confidence. I think the public, most likely is listening to this spat saying, well, we don't really know who to believe. I mean, Trump supporters are going to believe him.
Right.
They're going to think, that's the Washington establishment is after Trump. But Trump skeptics are going to say, well, no, I mean, the president-elect is coming in just shooting from the cuff and, making these kinds of accusations. I mean, it's not the only accusations he's been making, and I think it's extremely harmful to the functioning of our government.
We're talking about Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, the U.S. and Russia, Donald Trump and the intelligence establishment, the investigations into this dossier. Interestingly, our guest doesn't believe he'll know the full truth until people retire, maybe 20 or 30 years from now. Do you have confidence, our listeners, that somebody will get to the truth of this sooner rather than later? What would it take to get to the truth of this? What do you make of Donald Trump's praise of Vladimir Putin? Is that of concern to you? We are speaking this hour with Professor Ted Gerber. He is a professor of sociology and director of the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia at UW-Madison. Here is our phone number. I would imagine we'll have a lot of calls, so get your call in early, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. We already have a couple messages for Professor Gerber. We'll get to those momentarily. We're on Facebook at the Kathleen Dunn Show and Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to a couple messages, and then tons of phone calls are coming in for you, Professor Gerber. A caller from Madison wanted to know if Russia is considered our adversary or an alliance. If they're an adversary, isn't getting friendly with them a reasonable offense?
Well, I think the answer is our policy has wavered, and our perceptions of Russia have wavered since the collapse of the Soviet Union. During the 1990s, there was a hope, and indeed, I think some possibility that Russia would be our friend. And I think, unfortunately, I think that turned out to be overly optimistic. I think things changed when Putin became president. Russia itself went through a very difficult time in the 1990s, and there are aspects of Russian society, Russian history, Russian culture, Russian politics, which make it hard for any Russian leader to accept a world in which Russia is not a powerful country. Now, the Russians say, like, their official position is that they want what they call a multipolar world, where there are different centers of power, different great powers, almost sort of a balance of power the way the Cold War was, where there was a balance between the Soviet Union and the United States. And what they decry, what they're upset about, they say, is that the current world is one of U.S. global hegemony, where the United States, both seeks to and achieves a certain power over the rest of the world, which they feel, they argue is inimical both to Russia's interests and also to the world's interests. So the Russians themselves, they say that, they're not against the United States as such. They're simply trying to protect their interests. From my perspective, I think this is misleading. I mean, I think, I try not to take sides in these things as an analyst, but of course, as an American citizen, I have some sense of what American interests are. I think that Russia, it does pose a threat to the United States, and it has been an adversary to the United States for quite some time. If you read the speeches of Putin, if you read what the leader of the country says, it's very hostile towards America on all levels. And I think our leaders need to awaken to the fact that Russia is behaving as if the United States is its enemy. So I think it is fair to think of Russia more as an adversary than as a friend. Now, that doesn't mean we can't cooperate on certain issues. That doesn't mean we can't find common ground. In terms of, whether the question as to whether or not, given that Russia has an adversarial position towards the United States, whether we should try to extend our hand and create or improve relations. Well, yes and no. That depends. Of course, in an ideal world where we could trust the Russians and trust their intentions and work out agreements, that would be acceptable. But what I fear is that we've crossed a line. We crossed that line sometime in early 2014, where it's no longer advisable to treat the Russian government as a well-intentioned partner, that we need to interpret all of its actions, all of its statements, all of its agreements, even in terms of reaching agreements, with tremendous suspicion and recognition that they do not mean us well. They do not, they've spent a lot of money, blood and treasure, as the military people might put it, in trying to undermine U.S. interests. It is not just a casual effort on their part. They've invested a lot of resources in thwarting U.S. interests in U.S. policy and European. I mean, they're very active in sowing divisions and dissent in Europe. So I think right now, the phase we are in, it makes more sense to take a tougher line, to try to assert our to resist the actions that the Russians have taken to undermine U.S. interests.
So how do we treat then Vladimir Putin's description of Donald Trump as a brilliant and talented person without a doubt and as an absolute leader for the 2016 election? What's behind that?
Well, in my opinion, I mean, I think the Russians made an assessment. They clearly did not like Hillary Clinton, and they I think they did not really expect Trump to win. I think that they thought that he would lose, just as all the experts and all the polls predicted, but that they could use their support of Trump to undermine Hillary Clinton. So why would they prefer Trump? Well, it's a good question, because one thing we know about Putin is he doesn't like big surprises. He doesn't like uncertainty. He likes to be able to feel that he has control of the situation. And Trump, if nothing else, is a very uncertain, he's a question mark. No one really knows what he's going to do, what he's going to say. He doesn't seem to have any, he has no record of public service. So we can't really, he has no sort of record of policy statements. I mean, yes, he has tweets, but anybody can tweet anything anytime, So why would the Russians want someone like Trump? Well, first of all, that immediately raises a question. Perhaps they feel that they can control him, and perhaps, it does lend some credibility. The story certainly sounds about right to me, that the Russians maybe have identified someone like Trump for quite some time as someone who they would like to cozy up to, would like to make friends with, would like to play nice with, and perhaps would like to establish some compromising material on, because You know, that is how politics works in Russia. That's how the Russian elite is held together. They all have dirt on each other. They all systematically go about as some Russian sociologist. In fact, there's a Russian sociologist who is based in London named Alyona Ledynyova, who has written, you know, several books describing the ways in which the Russian elite is based on the cohesion of the Russian elite is based on kompromat, you know, the word that's, yes, that's come into our vocabulary in the last few weeks. And so I think, you know, they probably figure that Trump, you know, by his own statements, he seems to be pro-Russian. He possibly could be counted on to, you know, depart from what Clinton's policies would have been, which would have been hardline. By all accounts, everything he said and done suggests that he might indeed provide an opening. So when I first heard Trump, talking up Putin and so forth during the campaign, my own reaction was, oh, well, he's probably just trying to distance himself from Clinton to try to draw contrast. And yes, I mean, there have been various business interests with the United States. Rex Tillerson, his appointee to Secretary of State, is a good example of that, who have advocated for more cooperation, a softer line. Throughout, you know, there's been a sort of tension between the human rights and pro-democracy side of the U.S. government and the chambers of commerce and the more economically oriented side, shall we say, in terms of how to deal with Russia, which runs all throughout, you know, foreign policy. And I think why not, from the Russians' perspective, why not take a gamble on Trump, especially if you have some material on him, as opposed to, you know, pretty much what you're going to get with Clinton. So I think it is a bit of a puzzle, because it doesn't seem to be consistent with what we know about Putin's preferences. It doesn't really make sense. But that's my interpretation, and that's why when this report about the dossier and the alleged compromise on Trump came out, you know, to me, it has a ring of truth to it. Now, I'm not saying it's true.
Right.
So I don't want to be misunderstood.
No, you're not.
Have any, but you know, to me, I would hardly be surprised, let's put it that way. It would be fully consistent with how I think about the Russian government and its how power works in
getting
Russia.
Dirt on him. Right. Interesting. Let's go to Eric in Milwaukee. Hi, Eric.
Thank you, Kathleen, for an always informative show.
You're welcome, Eric.
My impression over several years is that there is a strong element of Russian organized crime in the greater New York area. Given Trump's business dealings, I cannot help but wonder, one, what that comes to bear in this whole mix about, and two, why we haven't heard anything about it.
All right. Thanks, Eric. Professor Erber.
That's a good question. There has been some recent investigative reporting that's starting to come out about Trump's connections with various individuals, some of whom have indeed, you know, who have connections with the Russian mafia, Russian organized crime, and who have been active in New York. So far, there hasn't been a sort of paper trail that reveals, sort of knee-deep or hip-deep involvement between Trump. But I think that there are reporters who are working in this. In fact, I believe in yesterday's or today's New York Times, there was an article which started to mention or started to discuss some of the findings. There have been some things published on the web which appear to me on the face of them to be fairly well-researched. I think that this is a story that's going to continue to grow. I think it's people can do digging, they can trace meetings and contacts and connections. So there have been, you know, several individuals who've been reported to have had meetings with Trump, negotiations. I think there are still questions which, you know, he could quite easily resolve if he were to release his taxes.
His taxes, which isn't happening, and you wonder why that's not happening.
Exactly.
Right?
You really wonder why. So, you know, there are many reasons why he might not want to do that, and one of them is that they may reveal that he does have some deep financial obligations to entities in Russia or connections with Russia. So far as I know, you know, there hasn't been yet divulged any sort of smoking gun types of connections. However, I think people are just starting to get your investigative journalists thank goodness there are still some out there. They are getting going on this, and I think I would not be at all shocked to see more reports coming out in the coming months.
Rick is calling in next. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The previous caller sort of stole my thunder, but I'll add on to it. David K. Johnson has reported on Trump's possible connections with the Russian oligarchs, or perhaps dealings with various Russian mafia figures. But even more to the point was that, as you pointed out, curiously, all throughout his campaign, President-elect Trump had talked about weakening NATO, that it was no longer relevant, and had heaped praise on Vladimir Putin. So if you combine the fact that he has been fairly consistent with that approach with the sort of elements that have already been somewhat unearthed by David K. Johnson, and the fact that he refuses to release his tax returns or give us a glimpse into his financial holdings, I think it just, you know, it's not a smoking gun, but the old saying where there's smoke, there's fire. It just seems to me that this is perhaps even more important than this dossier.
Hmm. Okay, thank you so much, Rick, for your call. Professor Gerber.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I should come clean and say that I myself, am quite suspicious of President-elect Trump. It seems to me highly unusual that he's taken such a strong pro-Russian stance. It's highly unorthodox. I mean, I'll give him that he's not sort of playing by the standard American political playbook, in which the policies towards postures, shall we say, towards Russian among our candidates have varied from, like, well, we should be very suspicious of them, yet we should try to treat them as partners and try to, help them improve their democratic institutions, help them improve their economy, to, well, they're all-out enemies, and they're enemy number one, which, you know, is how I would characterize, eventually, the policy of the Obama administration. I mean, the outgoing Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, cited Russia as the main threat to international security above, you know, it's ISIS is up there, but he put Russia number one. So I was really surprised, and I'm still to this day, you know, it doesn't really add up from an analytical perspective why the U.S. and why NATO is obsolete, and why, in the face particularly of the events of the last several years, in which Putin has essentially invaded a sovereign country, for the second or third time. This is hardly the first time, his actions in Ukraine, and also has really accelerated his involvement in the Middle East, has opposed us, in Iran, has engaged in propaganda efforts to undermine European solidarity. So I'm very, very to put it mildly, I'm very, very concerned that there's more going on than his objective assessment of what's in the best interest of the United States.
Well, you also, let's talk about Congress for a moment, because you have this amazing thing happening with more and more Democratic members of Congress saying that they're not going to attend the inaugural. You have Congressman John Lewis talking about the president not being legitimate because of Russian interference in the U.S. election. You have Maxine Waters saying that she didn't think he was legitimate, and talking about classified information that members of Congress have received. You have to believe, in this age of who knows where news is coming from, Professor Gerber, that somebody's going to leak the information that Congress has been given about all of this, don't you think?
Well, yes. I mean, I wouldn't count on that as an inevitability by any means, but it's certainly possible. And what concerns me, like, stepping back, I mean, so I certainly, you know, I'm very concerned about the Trump administration. I'm glad that some Democrats are actively, expressing their displeasure. They're not doing anything that's violating the law. They're still going to perform their governmental roles. There's no requirement that they attend the inauguration. But what concerns me is that this is exactly the kind of situation that the Russians have sought to create, which is one where we don't know whom to believe. We don't know whom to trust. I mean, do we believe, so the CIA releases this report, they release a dossier, it's for public consumption, they say that there's classified material. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where if you are already skeptical of Trump, and if your
exactly
assessment of this situation is such that you think there's probably some some wrongdoing there or something fishy going on, then you're going to believe, you're going to take at face value their claims that they just can't tell us. But if you're a Trump supporter and you think that this is all a big, you know, sour grapes or whatever he calls it, then you're going to say, no, this is ridiculous.
I know. And so where does that leave us as a country, for heaven's sake, really?
It's very distressing. I think we're all in a position where I think, you know, informed people don't really know what to believe. And we've gotten into a situation where we choose to believe that which already confirms our pre-existing assessments of the situation, which is a very dangerous circumstance to be in.
Yeah. Professor Ted Gerber is our guest this hour, director of the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia at UW-Madison. He's also a professor of sociology. We're talking about the U.S. and Russia, what Donald Trump would like to have the relationship be, why he is praised so often and for so long Vladimir Putin, what Vladimir Putin has said about Donald Trump, what Donald Trump has said about the intelligence agencies and the information contained in the dossier, and what members of Congress, how they're responding, and on it goes. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network. Okay, back to phone calls, and let us go to Keith in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Keith.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Hello, Professor.
Hello.
So I do have one comment and a comment, I guess, a question. So the first comment is in respect to Mr. Trump, all throughout the campaign, things he said, his rhetoric, at the very least, the way he would exaggerate facts or, I mean, blatantly just make things up. How are we supposed to, as a country, as an individual, or even believe anything he would even remotely have to say about someone as like Russia that over the years have never wanted anything good for us per se. How good for us is good for them, I think is just rubbish. And second off, I've heard the argument in the last couple of days that the real problem that the United States is going to have is with China. And which side do we want Russia to have on? And to think that Russia just would magically turn their back on their neighbor over there and just back us up, I think is just blindly being foolish. And I think we ought to just be very careful with that. And I'll take the comments off.
All right. Thanks, Keith.
Yes, it absolutely cuts against the grain of, you know, what I think would be irrational policy for any country, which would be to be very suspicious of foreign governments that manifestly have sought to undermine, oppose, and thwart the interests of, you know, one's own country. So I agree, and I don't think, you know, Trump has provided any real meat in terms of analysis. So, you know, people are certainly free to take different views, and there have been some voices in the United States among observers of Russia. So, you know, one example is there's a professor at NYU named Stephen Cohen who has appeared, you know, has made a name for himself by appearing on in media and so forth in condemning American policy as being too anti-Russian, blaming the actions of the United States for Russia's actions, and effectively advocating that the United States just step back and let Russia hold sway in the former Soviet Union and try to cooperate. So it's not like there's no one in you know, in respectable circles, so to speak, who's taken this position. But Trump has not done so. I mean, his reasoning seems to be very flip. Like, oh, I think Putin's a great leader, therefore, you know, we should. Well, I mean, he probably would say the same thing about other leaders across the world, who he may think are strong and tough, like the leader, you know, leaders of countries like China and North Korea and other places. And that's not a reason to cozy up to leaders of foreign countries just because they're tough. And so I certainly agree. In terms of China, I think, indeed, it's a little fanciful to argue that we're going to be able to sort of pry Russia away and align with Russia against China. I think that's kind of simplistic way of thinking about the world. I don't think the Chinese, I think that the Chinese are enjoying this recent conflict themselves. I think their policy is to sort of sit back and wait, to continue to build up their economy, to build up their capacities, to their foreign policy is driven by economic interests largely, although they're certainly causing problems for us in the South China Sea of late. And I think, they see Russia is in a position of weakness, which is objectively the case, given Russia's struggling economy over the last period here with its oil dependence on oil revenues. And yet, China has some advantages in dealing with Russia. It shares a large border with Russia. It has strong economic ties with Russia. It certainly is going to provide is going to be quite happy to strike deals to receive Russian natural gas and oil because it needs those commodities, and Russia is willing to strike deals. So I think it's going to be a very tall order to try to drive a wedge between Russia and China. It's also not clear to me what really the U.S. is in a position to offer Russia aside from backing out of sanctions. I don't know. Is it really the case that the United States wants to get rid of NATO? I mean, NATO has been a key component of America's power across the world, the world over. I mean, NATO has supported us in efforts in Afghanistan and Iraq. I can't see any serious analyst in our government actually thinking that NATO is not helpful to the United States. And so and nor have I heard an argument from Trump other than making a bunch of blithe assertions as to why that would be the case.
What about reducing our nuclear stockpile in return for a lessening of sanctions, and also Donald Trump's statements that, maybe you can get the Russians to do the same thing? That's good, isn't it?
Well, in principle, I certainly think nuclear disarmament is a policy to be pursued. But the question is one of trust. This question is one of verification. And, I think that's something that has to be negotiated. I mean, the Russians themselves it's far more burdensome on their economy. And, in fact, the very collapse of the Soviet Union, in large part, the proximate cause was a recognition on the part of Soviet leaders that they could not afford to keep up with the United States in the nuclear arms race. And that, they were really frightened by the prospect of, let's say, missile defense. Now, the Russians are particularly upset about missile defense, and there was a particular bone of contention with the Obama administration. Now, I'm not a scientist. From what I understand, the science of – so we're talking about, technology that would thwart a nuclear attack by shooting down the nuclear weapons as they're heading towards the country. So the science of that has progressed, but there have been some setbacks, and there were plans to install early warning systems and so forth in Eastern Europe that the Russians really objected to because, from their perspective, that would upset the balance of power. So I think that is an area in which the United States has better cards. And I think, if anything, we should be using that as leverage over the Russians. I think it's more costly, more frightening, more important to them to reach an agreement than it is for us. Although, they throw their weight around. They're developing new weapon systems. They say they're going to put weapons, in Kaliningrad or wherever, in parts that can reach Europe. They're going to so they're trying to puff out their chest, so to speak, and to threaten us, but in the long term, that's a strategic advantage of the United States, from my perspective. Mm. So I don't see that as something that we want them to make concessions to us on. It's more like they want us to make concessions to them. I don't know what they can offer us other than trying to behave themselves. They're not going to withdraw from Ukraine. They're not going to give a – well, they might withdraw from Donbass. That's not implausible. It's highly unlikely, though. They're not going to give back Crimea. They're not going to cooperate with us in any meaningful way in the Middle East. They really don't have much to offer us.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we have to say goodbye. I'm going to ask that we get in touch with you, and if you can come up with a list of what we should be reading to find out where indeed the truth is on all of this, it would be extraordinarily helpful to our audience. Thank you very much for being
you.
With us.
It's
been a very,
pleasure.
Very interesting hour. Professor Ted Gerber, Professor of Sociology, Director of the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia at UW-Madison. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this interesting show, and Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks for listening. Thanks for all of your calls. We'll come up with a list of what you should read on this on Facebook.